Morning, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. On today's broadcast, many African-American women are dying from preventable diseases. So many women are spending so much time taking care of others that they neglect taking care of themselves. The Primetime Sister Circles aims to change that. Dr. Gail Porter from the Black Mental Health Alliance explains how. Then, two women who are icons of the art scene, Betty Cook and Joyce J. Scott, on their exhibition of jewelry at the Baltimore Jewelry Center. Plus, the Nepalese holiday of Dashen is coming up. We'll find out how to celebrate with musician and restaurateur Prem Raja Bahat. Tom Pelton brings us the environment in focus. Nathan Sterner has the local news. That's all coming up on Maryland Morning, right after the national headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The African proverb, "It takes a village," animates a lecture series developed in the wake of the riots and uprising in Baltimore last spring. The Black Mental Health Alliance is curating a series of talks on health needs in communities facing high rates of poverty and unemployment. The Alliance was founded in 1983 to provide training, resource referrals, and education. The lecture series is called Baltimore Rising, Summoning the Village. Next up on the series tomorrow night will be Dr. Gail Porter. She is the co-director of the Gaston and Porter Health Improvement Center in Georgetown, an organization that provides free health services for Black women between the ages of 40 and 75. One of her most well-known projects is called Primetime Sister Circles, a free nationwide support group that focuses on helping women of color deal with a spectrum of health challenges. Dr. Porter joins me in the studio along with Cherie Brown, who was a participant in a Baltimore Primetime Sister Circle a decade ago. Welcome to you both. Dr. Porter, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta says that half of the deaths of Black women from things like heart disease or cancer, stroke, diabetes, half of these deaths are premature, and the vast majority of them are preventable. This is a huge problem. Tell us how we've gotten to that point.
Well, we've been in crisis around this issue for decades, but unfortunately, it has not been an issue that's been given much focus, except when we go to the funerals of our mothers and our grandmothers and our great-grandmothers who are dying at 60, 61, 62, as opposed to a normal lifespan. And the sad news is that it's taking this just deluge of deaths and of sadness to finally have us starting to recognize how serious it is. The good news is that we can do something about it. We don't have to die prematurely from preventable illnesses. And even more importantly, we don't have to leave that as a legacy for our children.
And we should be clear, the rates of morbidity and mortality in the African-American women community are much higher than they are in Caucasian, Asian, Hispanic communities.
They're even higher than they are in our Native American sisters. So we are dying from these preventable illnesses at a rate that is greater than any other group of women and most men. But I also want to say that our levels of depressive symptomatology and stress are also higher. And probably one of the most important findings is that when we get older, many of us think about the golden girls. Well, our older years are not golden. They are often full of sickness, both physical and emotional.
You wrote a paper in the Journal of the National Medical Association a few years ago with your colleague, Dr. Gaston, Marilyn Hughes Gaston, and it was interesting. It talked about the paradoxy of the issue of obesity in particular, saying that there was no difference in the prevalence of obesity when you divided by socioeconomic class. If there is no difference between people in poorer communities and more well-off communities, what are the causes of these rates of morbidity and mortality?
The paradoxes of obesity are different in terms of some of the other areas. For instance, if you have more money as an African-American woman or man, you are probably going to live longer than our sisters and brothers who don't have access to better housing or to better education. But what we found that is truly unique for Black women, we are the only group of women who education and income are not protective factors against obesity. In every other group, as their income increases in terms of women, they are much more apt to be fit. They are much more apt to be within the normal range of weight. That is unfortunately not true for us. And it's one of the reasons that even those of us who have money and education are still dying at rates that are greater than other groups of women.
And Sheree Brown, you were a member of a primetime sister circle. And we should say that primetime refers not to, you know, 8 o'clock at night, but primetime of life between 40 and 75 African-American women in that age cohort. What was your experience? What was the primetime circle like for you?
I will say that I was probably around 47 at that time, and I went with my mother, who was 70. And we do so much in terms of giving to our families, you know, supporting ministry, supporting friends, that this was an opportunity for us to really go and have me time, our time. We can just focus on ourselves and focus on our needs and have fun while we were doing it. So it was a very memorable experience for me.
So Dr. Porter and her colleague provide you with a basic curriculum, a basic list of things you want to accomplish in a 12-week program. What sort of things did you talk about and discuss?
Health. We talked about our eating habits, you know, what we were doing right, what we could do better. We talked about exercise, fitness. What was really nice was that there were professionals who were there. So when we would come, we had persons who took our blood pressure, they took our weight and just monitored different things on a weekly basis.
And a big part of this, Dr. Porter, is the fact that people have the opportunity to do this in a group. And there's a lot of evidence, a lot of data that says, you know, if you do this with other people, you have that extra motivation. It's not like you're out there, you know, flailing around by yourself.
And they also hold you accountable, mm-hmm. so that when you come in and you say, well, I didn't get to walk, or I haven't dealt with my job in terms of my stress level, these sisters look at you and say, oh, I don't want to hear that. Why aren't you doing it? What are you doing? We encourage the sisters to go home and share this with their families. In fact, we tell them, we want you to be revolutionaries, and you're going to change your family, your community.
The big part of it is women are spending so much time taking care of everybody else that they don't take any time to take care of themselves.
Many of our women are Christian, but we tell them, you know, what did Jesus say? That you are to love others as you love yourself. And we often forget that part. But we've had sisters who are Muslim, who are atheists, and they all say that it's such a reminder of the power of what can happen when you do take care of yourself, and then you take care of other people.
And health, of course, and this is in the introduction to your book, Jocelyn Elders, a physician, wrote an introduction. She talks about how health is more than just the absence of disease.
Exactly.
So this is really a holistic
thing.
It
is. Having that mind, body, spirit connection, helping people to understand you can't just do one part, you know, that it really is a holistic approach, has truly made a difference for the women who've gone through the program.
Because there are some cultural things, and Sheree Brown, I mean, when you go to church and they're serving that beautiful pound cake after church and fellowship, you know, or is there that phenomenal fried chicken or something? I mean, you're talking about making people make different decisions about things like that, as well as, you know, the exercise and that. I mean, was this something you all talked about?
We did talk about that in the sense of it was just very practical. It was very real. So the conversations we had, the materials that were provided, we could really relate them to our day-to-day experiences. And as Dr. Porter was saying, it was information that we could actually go back and share with our families in terms of, you know, true, false, and with regard to myths, helping us understand certain myths that were out there with regard to exercise, with regard to illnesses such as hypertension or high blood pressure. It's like, wow, I didn't know that by doing such things as maybe walking for as little as 10 to 15 minutes a day could make a big difference in terms of preventing ailments such as that.
For example, did you and your mom find in your family a receptivity on behalf of the men and the other and the children in your family to understanding that, okay, we all got to get together and help mom and grandma take care of stuff?
Well, I'd have to say there were probably mixed feelings, because when we're talking about going home and having generations of having food where there's pork in the greens or fried foods, and we were so used to eating that way, we had to maybe introduce some of the changes a little bit at a time. We were having more perhaps steamed vegetables, baked fish, baked chicken, things of that sort. Mm-hmm. So it took a little time, but hey, without the primetime sisters, maybe we wouldn't have been doing that at all. And my mother is 80, and she's still here with us today.
That's great. I mean, Dr. Porter, how much of this has to do with access to health care?
When we talk about health outcomes, we cannot not talk about income inequality, because there's no question there are places where even if you wanted to buy healthy food, you don't have a Giant. You don't have a Safeway around. If you wanted to walk outside, you know, you're afraid to do that. Always being aware of the impact of institutionalized racism and sexism is something we, and classism, we have to do. But what we say to women is that just as maybe once every 2 weeks or once a week you go to the mall, you find some friends, what we say to you, once a week, carpool and go to a place where you can buy some good food. When you go to that mall, instead of shopping, which is bankrupting us anyway, go and walk around the pool, walk around the mall, as opposed to buying in the mall. So there are things that we can do, no matter what our income level, while we're fighting to ensure that women and men and children who don't have access can get that access. We're fighting to expand their access.
Well, thanks to both of you. I really appreciate your time, and best of luck in the future. Appreciate it.
And
thanks for having us.
Right.
Cherie Brown was a part of a primetime sister circle in 2005. Dr. Gail Porter is the co-director of the Gaston and Porter Health Improvement Center and the co-author of Primetime, the African-American Woman's Complete Guide to Midlife Health and Wellness. She'll be speaking about the disparities in health outcomes faced by African-American women tomorrow night, 6 o'clock at the UB Blake Cultural Center on North Howard Street here in Baltimore. Her remarks will be followed by a panel discussion with Katie Alston from Marion House, the Reverend Deborah Hickman, the founder of Sisters Together and Reaching, and Sister Leslie Muhammad, the director of the Nation of Islam Women and Girls Training Program. We've got all the details on our website, as well as more of our conversation. Come to wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, we've got two sisters who have been part of the Primetime International Art Community. Stay with us. I'm Tom Hall. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall, along with Nathan Sterner. The Baltimore Jewelry Center in the new Center Building on North Avenue in the Station North Arts and Entertainment District is a resource for emerging and established metal and jewelry artists. It offers classes and studio space, and now the center is holding its first exhibition featuring the work of three acclaimed artists with strong Baltimore roots: Shanna Kreutz, Joyce J. Scott, and Betty Cook. The exhibition also features some of the work of the current faculty at the Jewelry Center. Joyce J. Scott and Betty Cook join me in the studio. Their work is known internationally, and like the Jewelry Center, their history in Baltimore includes the Maryland Institute College of Art. Betty graduated from MICA in 1946. It had a different name then, and she taught there for more than 20 years. Joyce also received a degree from MICA and went on to get a graduate degree from Mexico's Institute Allende. She has taught community community arts in Baltimore and across the U.S., and she has also performed regularly as a singer and theater artist. Great to see both of you. How y'all doing?
Good.
I'm delighted to have the two grand dames of Baltimore jewelry and many other things with me in the studio. So, Betty, you're 91 years old.
Oh, thank you very much.
I just imagine I couldn't help.
I just got to get that out, you know, because it's
all right.
I'm all for it. You're all for it, and we're all for it too.
Okay.
We are glad that that's happened. And what's in this show? Is this new work, or have you gotten all retrospective on
it? Some are retrospective because I thought it was interesting for the students to see the kinds of work that I did in the 40s and 50s mm-hmm. and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
So it's the whole thing.
But there is some new work, too. I mean, you are still working regularly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And is your schedule, your routine of creating work, has that changed much?
There's no routine. I take advantage of every minute I can find.
Mm-hmm. And you have a tough time finding minutes because you're running a store, the store limited up in Cross Keys.
Correct. And that's very interesting, too. I mean, that's where my customers are, and that's why I do what I do.
What are the new pieces that you have in this show? Can you describe them for us?
Well, it's a very simple, I would say, a very active sort of sculptural piece. It's a gold wire with two pieces of silver. That's a real simple explanation.
Yeah, and if it's a simple piece.
Swishy wire and very well-formed silver. And
yeah.
It just is a piece of sculpture, really.
Yeah.
It's a piece of sculpture.
Uh-huh. And Joyce J. Scott, your work is highly informed by a number of things, not the least of whom is your mom.
My age.
Well,
go ahead. So try it.
Because you'll hit me. I'm a chicken at heart, you know, so I'm not doing that. You are not yet 91. I'll say that.
Let's do it that way.
And let's hope that you get there in due time. But your mom, Elizabeth Talford Scott, a terrific artist with whom you worked and, you know, and obviously influenced by her. You've studied the art of West Africa, Native American art, and also your experience of living in the city. You are from here. What pieces did you decide to pick for this particular show?
The majority of the work is new. And I'm a sculptress who is also a jeweler. So I was working on pieces that are really active and that flat and are sculptural and are mixed with beadwork and other materials. And although I love talking about myself, Thomas Hall, may I inject
and
something?
And I love having you talk about yourself.
Thank you. May I inject, and I mean that in the best possible way, something about the esteemed Betty Cook.
You may indeed.
I think that people don't... Those who don't know or who've never been to her store don't really understand the treasure that we have in Baltimore with Dame Betty Cook. And she is a dame as well.
Yep, and there's nothing like a dame, right?
It's one of the original purveyors of art jewelry. You know, jewelry has a long history, and jewelry many times was made, passed down through families and made so that you looked really great when you went to the opera and for ceremonies like weddings or presents. But then there was a real movement in the 40s, 50s, mm-hmm. and into the 60s when I started, of art jewelers who made jewelry as real works of art to not only be worn but to be celebrated and appreciated outside of all the social and family uses.
Mm-hmm.
And now that is an entire aesthetic for artists. And one of the people who made that possible internationally is Betty Cook.
Mm-hmm. So, Betty, you were a progenitor of this amazing movement.
Actually, it is called a movement now, but at the time, nobody thought they were part of a movement.
Sure.
I didn't think, well, I'm going to be a big movement here and come up with jewelry that is more sculpture. I didn't use the word jewelry back then. I said Betty Cook designer.
Right, right.
Because I thought the designs at that time were more important and people would expect a certain kind of jewelry, but this was a surprise. And
were you designing, you had a company with your husband, Bill Steinmetz, a design company.
Yes.
Where you were designing things other than jewelry, right?
We were. I mean, originally, for 10 years, I had a little, you know, place on Tyson Street, that little rundown important place. And I had a small shop, and I did
I was lucky to have amazing customers come through. Baltimore had some interesting people then that were interested in design and new things. It was actually the revolution of design. We had Charles Eames and Noguchi and all these wonderful people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it stood to reason to me that if you make jewelry, it has to be a concept that is new. And no, you don't think that way. You don't think you're doing something new. You do what you do.
And has there always been, though, an instinct, an impulse, or even a requirement in your work, Joyce, for example, that it be functional in that it can be worn? I mean, when people think about jewelry, you got to be able to wear it. But that's not the case with you. And is that even the case with you, Betty?
Not really. I mean, high heels aren't even something you'd want to think about either. There's a lot of clothing that you wouldn't want to wear, actually. But I think it is a scale to the human body, of course. And you want it to be comfortable in a way, but it can do all kinds of things that people hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, because Joyce, so much of your work is on display in museums and places like that. It's these are objets d'art, you know.
Yes,
these
they're actual sculptures. But I'm someone, and thank you for mentioning my mother, Elizabeth Telford Scott, who is in a quilt exhibition at the Baltimore Museum of Art right now. A lot of what I do, the impulse and that love, comes from my parents and the generations before them who were, in quotes, craft artists, who did work because they didn't have choice. If they wanted something, they had to make it. My mom gave me that ability to make, and so I am not codifying it, and I'm not making it a class where it, you know, jewelry has to be worn and it has to look like this and whatever, and sculpture has to look this and it has to have these materials. For me, whatever is best coming out of me is what, and that sounds so arty. My hands are, folks, my hands are flaying around as if I'm an artist.
You know, you're getting all artsy on.
Italian artist. You know, whatever's coming out of me is really important, and as long as I'm trying my best with it. I think also the idea or the knowledge that Betty and I are both artists who not only exhibited but sold internationally says a lot for artists who want to be artists and whose parents say, but you have to be a social worker because you can't make a living.
Right. Do your art on the weekends.
Yeah, you really can have a living at what you do if you're shrewd and make art.
And the musicality of both of your work is really beautiful to me. Right. The sense of motion, because music is all about motion. It's sound and time. And there's this great sense of motion in these inanimate objects that you create. Are you conscious of that, Betty?
I'm very conscious of it. I mean, you could make a drawing and decide to do something. You get an idea in your head, and I make drawings. I wouldn't call them firm, hard drawings. It might just be a lot of scratches you wouldn't understand. But I know exactly what it's going to look like, I think. But then you get in the middle of it and sometime it changes. And then sometime I'll have to look back and say, this is too static. And then it becomes, I like it to be free, as if it's in the wind or out there and moving on people.
Yeah.
She just said it. It's not that it's static. It's moving on people. Yeah.
The artist Joyce J. Scott, she's here with Betty Cook. They have a design exhibition of their work, we'll call it that, an exhibition of their art at the Baltimore Jewelry Center in Station North.
He was so good looking, he got flummoxed.
I do. That happens every time I see both of you. So Joyce makes this point, Betty, about making a living. And your path has been very interesting, and I would think it's very educative for the young people at the Jewelry Center. You decided to have a commercial establishment. Not every artist does that. You have the Store LTD, which you've had up in Cross Keys now for how many years?
50 years.
God bless. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's an interesting path. Is that a path that you're finding the young people you talk to, the ones you mentor, the ones who ask you for advice, is that a particular road you're finding other kids starting to follow?
I think so. I mean, I think they're very aware of that now, and they're very much more savvy now as far as business and communication is, and I think it's a great... It's going to be great out there because they're so well trained, speaking of jewelry and metalwork, which is so important what we're talking about, but they're so well trained. So many colleges are giving excellent courses in this that it's becoming a thing to express yourself in, and with good design ideas and the proper equipment and education. Now, the business part of it, I think part of that is instinct. I was just raised with the idea that I was going to earn a living somehow. I don't know who told me that, but I had to get a degree, and from then on in, it would be okay. You just make your way.
Mm-hmm. And you Joyce, do. Your work, of course, very much informed and inflamed by activism. You have mm-hmm. been yeah. active in civil rights movements and various other
as things. A visual artist.
As a visual
not
artist.
Not as a marcher, unfortunately.
Right. But you're close to those things emotionally and yeah. artistically. That is also, it seems to me, another trend that I'm noticing in the artists that are coming out of places mm-hmm. like MICA and other places.
I think that for a while, people felt that the model was the French artist in a garret with the beret, you know?
Yeah, La Bohème.
Yeah, La Bohème.
And they have to die of consumption at the end.
Something like that.
Very
in
young.
Absinthe and have Bardot pictures on the wall. But quite honestly, I didn't grow up in an art village, in an art hill, and drink art drinks and only read art books. I'm a citizen of the world who has the same concerns as everyone else. And I am, in fact, influenced and hurt by the things that hurt everyone else. So my best voice to help make a change is via my artwork. I don't think everyone has to do that. That's just the thing that works for me. And growing up in the 60s and being in college in the 60s up to 1970, and not only being in college and learning my stuff within my own life, but going to Mexico. You know, at the same time in the 60s and in the 70s, students were dying all around the world, not unlike what's happening now. So you become inculcated with the knowledge that it's up to you, and people do it in very different ways. I mean, just being a good person is such an enormous step in a world where you have options not to be. And also you said to her about, are students, you know, more savvy about this? Yes, I mean, the internet and
it's just
different
technology ways of
communicating
has about it, yeah.
made it, but also I left school without a lot of bills. If you're leaving school with $20,000 or $30,000 to pay off, you're going to figure out how to make some money.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are only so many waitresses, or do you know what I mean? There are real ways to help you live a better life.
The artists Betty Cook and Joyce J. Scott. The exhibition at the Baltimore Jewelry Center is called Passing from One Hand, Betty Cook, Joyce J. Scott, Shanna Kreutz, and a Tradition of Metalsmithing and Jewelry in Baltimore. The center is in the new building called The Center. It's spelled C-E-N-T-R-E at 10 East North Avenue. That's between Charles Street and St. Paul Street in Baltimore. We've got a link to information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It is a delight to see you both, and I hope lots of folks go down and see the show. It'll be there till the middle of November.
Well, thank you,
Tom. Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. Thanks for being with us. Coming up a little later on the program, a conversation about the Nepalese holiday of Dashain. It takes place tomorrow, and we'll learn about it from musician and a restaurateur, Prem Raja Mahat. The Environment in Focus with Tom Pelton is coming up, too. But first, we'll check in again with Nathan Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Maryland Morning, I'm Tom Hall. About 15% of Marylanders were born outside the United States. Maryland's ethnic diversity spans people from all over the globe. And now we'll take a look at a holiday being celebrated by the Nepalese community in the Free State. That numbers about 20,000 people. The Nepalese Festival of Dashain is upon us. The multi-day festival wraps up next week. The main day of the festival is tomorrow. Prem Raja Mahat joins me in the studio to tell us about Dashain. Prem has lived in Baltimore since the mid-1990s, where he and his wife wife Kabita own a restaurant called the Nepal House in Mount Vernon. Prem is also a folk music star in Nepal, where he had the top-selling album in the country for 10 years straight. So this is a multi-week festival. This is the biggest festival, and this is a religious holiday in Nepal. Huh? What's the basis of the holiday?
Our biggest festival we celebrate. This is all the people, all the whole Nepalese people who lives in Nepal and abroad. All the Nepalese people celebrate this festival, and this is a long festival. There is many festival, but this one is we celebrate more, like week to week. We like to eat, meet our people, greet each other, and that's why we do this.
You've been in America now for quite a number of years. Is there an American holiday that is kind of the same thing? Is this closer to Christmas or Easter, or is it the 4th of July or Labor Day?
Yeah, this is very closer to the Thanksgiving and Christmas. You know, we have the similar festival in Nepal and America. The Thanksgiving look like similar to the our Dasai, this Dasara call, and then our Diwali, Tihar. This is similar to Christmas lighting everywhere in the lighting, every house, you know.
So are there customs that you are used to celebrating in Nepal that you do here in America, or do you celebrate this holiday now that you're in America? Do you celebrate it in a different way?
We do the custom in Nepal, and we do here the same dress, we eating same food, and bringing all the culture same. And we have the symbolic. There is some symbol like we call tika.
And tika are the symbols that
symbol,
you have.
Yeah, tika, yes. Then we do each other this tika, and then we have called jamara. There is a small sprout from the barley and corn.
Uh-huh. That is so that's a special food you're eating.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And we do in the our here, and we eat a lot of meat and everything, and we invite our relative, and we have the big gathering in house. You know, this time it might be the big gathering in my house too.
Uh-huh. Nice. And you are a musician, as we mentioned. You're a very popular folk musician, and you've been nice enough this morning to bring over this beautiful instrument. It's called a sarangi.
Yes.
Maybe you could grab the sarangi and play us a little bit.
Yes, I can
great.
Play. This is really our number one instrument from the Nepal. We made in Nepal. This is our original instrument.
So it's an original instrument made in Nepal.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So you hold it kind of like a very small cello. It's about the size of an American viola. It has four strings on it. Mm-hmm. And you hold it in your lap, and you're going to cross the bow sort of across your torso. Yeah.
Just like a cello, and this is like a fiddle. We call it small fiddle, too.
Okay.
Look like a fiddle, and this will look like a cello, too.
Yeah. Here's Prem Raja Mahat playing a little on his sarangi.
I can play, and I can sing one song, too, about our festival.
Good.
Dasain aayo, tiyarai aayo, desh bidesh ma, Nepali ram aayo, tihar aayo, dasain aayo, desh bidesh ma, Nepali ram aayo. Like this.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's lovely. And do you play a lot at the Nepal House, your restaurant?
Yeah, I play in the Nepal House, and we have very good food in Nepal House, and then very good music too. And sometimes there comes more people, like a party, 20 people, 30 people, 40 people. They ask me about the Nepalese music, mm-hmm. and then I have this mini stage and lighting system, sound system, everything.
So for a big holiday like Dasain, I mean, do people come to the restaurant to celebrate, or is that always done in people's homes?
This festival, every people celebrate at home, mm-hmm. but we gather, every people gather in the one big hall, and we celebrate over there too.
Yeah, is it different? Is it, and is it make you homesick when you have to celebrate Dasan here in America? Do you get pangs of homesickness more so at this time of year than at other times of year?
Exactly. This time, you know, we remember our country, and when we celebrate here, and then we feel we every people want to go in the Nepal and then celebrate in the village, in the small town, and in the country. But this time and then, that's why we do here. We celebrate here, and we remembering our country and our family, all the people, and then we do same thing here, and we eat same thing here. We do same thing, and we enjoy also. We dance, we eat, everything we do here.
Yeah, it's a way of remembering home. Yeah, that's yes. Great. Well, Prem Rajat Mahat, it's been a delight to meet you, and thank you for coming in and playing and speaking with us. Appreciate it.
And thank you very much. Thank you, WYP, and Tom Home, and then every people who is listening this our program. Thank you
okay,
so
well,
much.
Happy this
year. And I like to welcome to in the Nepal House in Mount Vernon too, every people.
Prem Rajat Mahat, he's a Nepalese musician and restaurateur. He owns the Nepal House in Mount Vernon. We've got more information about Dasan on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Don't be crying on my soul.
I'd like to take a moment to share some recent feedback we received from some of our listeners.
James Gillis sent an email after Tom's story on the initiative called Hopkins Local and the task force that Morgan State University has appointed about what these large institutions can do to help Baltimore rebound from the uprising last spring. James writes, "As a resident of Southwest Baltimore, I live adjacent to the University of Maryland and know firsthand that they have been doing, both before April and since April, amazing things to engage the community and address the unrest. And I was wondering why UMD was not part of your program, especially because UMD borders the neighborhoods most affected by what happened."
James, WYPR's Fraser Smith is doing a lot of reporting on this very thing. We talked a little bit about what the University of Maryland is doing a couple of weeks ago, and we will be following up with Fraser in the coming weeks.
We also heard from Kristen Harbison from Baltimore, who was disappointed when she heard theater critic Jaywin Russick and Tom discuss a recent production of Kinky Boots at the Hippodrome Theater. The music for that Tony Award-winning musical is by Cyndi Lauper.
Kristen writes, "Cyndi Lauper is an accomplished and multiple award-winning songwriter who has grown in both subtlety and sophistication since she became a household name. She is one of only 20 artists to win a Grammy, an Emmy, and a Tony. She has been, for her entire career, groundbreaking, edgy, and progressive, both in her life and her music. And yet, you treated her like a flash in the pan from 30 years ago that has done nothing since, until she showed up to write a musical as quirky as her hair. She deserves better than that."
We appreciate your listening to Maryland Morning, and we hope you'll be in touch about what you hear on the show or what you'd like to hear. Please send us a tweet at Maryland Morning or an email. The address is mdmorning@wypr.org. I'm Nathan Sterner.
And I'm Tom Hall.